tonight on Arena. Eileen Walsh and playing the same scene 100 times with 100 different actors over 24 hours. And Bono brings his memoir to the screen for Apple TV. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. Delighted this evening to have Eileen Walsh with me. If you thought that theatre was a very simple matter, that you get the script, you learn your lines, and then you perform the story, middle in, and at the beginning, the middle and the ending, in front of an audience, well, you're going to have to think again when you hear about Eileen Walsh's new show. At the Cork Midsummer Festival this week, Eileen Walsh, who you'll know from Disco Pigs, from Small Things Like These, from the Magdalene Sisters, and a whole raft of other pieces, including, I would not say a scene-stealing, a series-stealing performance in Catastrophe.
Listen.
Eileen will be performing a single scene 100 times over 24 hours with 100 different actors who she doesn't know. Well, she knows very, very little about at this point in time. So what mad pill were you taking that day when you said, I'd love to do that?
Come on, I'll give it a go. I actually got to see the production when it happened in London with Ruth Wilson at the Young Vic. And it was so thrilling and so like a Marina Abramovich or something like that. Just, yeah, you can't control.
Almost like the artist is present. You're sitting, yes, there, a new actor arrives out, off you go.
Yeah, and it's such a lesson in letting go. Seeing what comes in the door. You can't really prepare. I can prepare for the repetition and I can prepare for how to get out of a sticky situation. Yeah. But I don't know what each person is going to bring in that door.
So do you have a set script? In other words, you learn your lines and no matter what happens, you say those lines, or is there a little bit of leeway within all of that?
Yeah, so there's 3 pages of dialogue and direction. The scene opens with an opportunity for the participant to say something that will be different, and I can respond to that. And then there's 2 pages of dialogue that are very much stuck to, but that includes getting a drink, eating some noodles and having a little discussion about trying to win him
props
back.
Props and business and
everything. I know. And then we share a kind of an intimate dance moment.
So this is, there's a scenario then. What's, yes, the relationship between the man and the woman? Because is, okay, it always a man, yeah?
Yeah. So the play itself, it's called The Second Woman, and it's based on a John Cassavetes film called Opening Night, where Jenna Rollins, who was Cassavetes's wife, Jenna plays this aging actor who is coming to terms with the life choices she's made and is having this very slow breakdown over the course of the film. And in the film, they're presenting this play, The Second Woman. She has an ex-lover in the play. And this is the scene where she turns up to the ex-lover and she's trying to get him interested in her again. And he isn't necessarily interested because he feels like she's trying to use him for the play.
Okay, but you have 100 different actors coming out over this 24-hour period. How long is the scene? Is it about 10
minutes?
It's
about 7 minutes.
7 minutes, okay.
Yeah.
So that's about, what is it, 4 or 5 an hour?
Six. And then you've got like
seven,
a brief,
maybe.
Yeah, you've got a brief few minutes at the end of each hour to reset props, drinking glasses, you know, if your makeup is smudged, or, you know, quick little checks.
And the actor, does he come out with set lines, or, you know, is he allowed to?
He has a brief there's a slight looseness around the beginning of it. So that
the opening section,
they can choose.
They can say whatever they want.
Yeah. You know, because perhaps they might want to say, look, as your father, they might want to distance themselves and not do a romantic scene. Yeah. So that's OK, too. And then at the end, they get to choose to leave on a positive or a negative. So each scene ending will also be different depending on his choice.
Yeah. And I guess they can come in annoyed at you, or they can come in thinking, I still feel great about this woman or whatever.
It can be romantic or it can be funny. It can be clumsy. They can be nervous. You know, a lot of them are just people who are willing to throw their hat into the ring.
Yeah,
they're not necessarily actors.
What kind of strikes me most about that is There's no way. How can you rehearse it? You can't get 100 different people every day for 3 weeks to rehearse it.
No, exactly. Well, and the two women that created it, Anna Brecken and Nat Randall, they've done it so many times. They've got a really restricted rehearsal. They know exactly what they're doing. And a lot of it is, I suppose, people management skills and me learning that and being physically open to whatever is going to be thrown at you.
And the audience then, how long are they there for?
So you can stay as long as you like. You can do the whole crazy trip with me for 24 hours or you can come and go. And even if you get the 24-hour ticket, you know, you can take rest breaks.
Oh, right,
you can kind of come in and out. There'll be an amazing food pop-ups outside in the opera house.
What about you and your food
pop-ups?
I'll have
plenty of noodles and I'll be running on adrenaline.
And do you sleep? Do you get a break at any point?
There's no sleeping. Now, Sean, I don't know how I'm going to manage that because I love my sleep. But
24 hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
It really is a marathon.
I know.
So when you went to see it in London, how long did you spend in the theatre?
We had to queue for 3 hours and even the queue was a buzz.
Kind of excitement. Yeah.
There was people kind of, you know, up and down the queue with lots of kind of chats going on and people were really kind of enthusiastic about seeing it. So we queued for 3 hours and then we finally got our ticket in and we watched for 3 hours. So by the time I left, it was like midnight.
How many did you see in that period of time? I suppose
if it's 21, 6 or 7, I saw 21 times.
7 an hour.
Yeah.
7 sevens is 49. Yeah. So yeah, okay. So about seven an hour. So you had seen 21 of the 100
iterations of it, and not one famous person, but all very capable. Even those that were obviously not actors, that were quite stunned by an audience looking at them, you know.
And this is the Opera House, isn't it? So it's not as if, I mean, a non-actor, it's not as if they're getting up in a little, you know, a small studio space.
No, it's big. Yeah. It's big or go home. It's going to be very exciting. And then there's three camera operators as well. So a lot of the smaller moments, touches and just details will be projected up on screen as well.
And Anne Brecken and Nat Randall, you mentioned the two women involved in it. They are directing this, are they?
Yeah,
you've spoken with them at this point.
Yeah, so it's all part of Cork Midsummer Festival, and but the women are coming over, and we'll do a full 2 weeks of rehearsal, be that to physically prepare as well as kind of get the right timings of everything. So I'll have them in the room and we'll be rehearsing in Cork and then we move into the Opera House.
I sure it was with Cork and the Opera House. That was what made you take the part. So, but I return to my first question. What mad pill were you taking? I mean, are you not afraid?
I'm terrified, but in a really good way. I think I kind of exist on yes and. Just jump. We'll worry about it later, you know. I was doing a yoga class recently and the teacher said, I know sometimes it feels like we're free falling without a parachute. And then she said, but the good news is there's no earth either. And so you think, okay, if I can exist in that, we're just free falling. That's all we're all doing.
So that's what you would be doing.
And that's
note. For 24 hours. That aspect of it, I mean, obviously, there is the thing that you want this challenge, you want to face that fear. Has that always been a kind of a driving force for you? You know, face the thing that you're most afraid of.
Yeah, I think you jump in and sometimes, you know, you can question your choices. But the majority of the time it works out. There's reasons for doing things. You're led and you don't know why. And, you know, otherwise you'd think too much and you'd think yourself out of it.
Yeah.
You know, so sometimes it's better to just say yes.
And I mean, I think back to this, I go back into the mists of time when I go back to Disco Pigs and yourself and Cillian Murphy, two young actors at that time doing that piece. Do you think there was the same type of fear then, or as many of us did when we were younger? We had less fear, didn't realise what we were letting ourselves in for.
Because we weren't afraid of judgment, really. I think it becomes more fearful now because you're afraid of failure. But, you know, that's all part of any creative job. And I think, to be fair, when I first read Disco Pigs, I hadn't a clue what it was about or what was happening in it. So it was the urge to work and to do something. And Enda spoke with such enthusiasm for it. I kind of felt like, I want to spend my summer with you, you know. So he was the reason.
And I mean, I heard him speaking recently about that was the thing that kind of established everything for him, that play. I mean, it ran for, what was it, 3 or 4 years?
Yeah, we did 2 years everywhere, and then we jumped off, and it was taken on. And then I was only just saying to somebody there outside that the three of us went back and saw it at the Young Vic. Kill wow. Enda and myself, and we saw recently. Charlie Murphy in it. Right. Yeah, it was amazing. Not recently, Jesus, yeah, that's like back. Probably still about 8, 9 years ago or right, something. Yeah.
However, more recently you were on the set with Cillian Murphy, small things like these, the Claire Keegan writing piece. An extraordinary piece of literature and an extraordinary film in the silences that are in the film.
Yeah. But I mean, Claire Keegan is an incredible writer. You know, she writes, she is relentlessly hard on all her characters. And she writes such rounded, profound, normal people that it was a real kind of thrill to be involved in it. And of course, Enda Walsh doing the adaptation again. So it was amazing.
And Kelly and the three of you.
Yeah.
The three of you. But was that the first time back together really as a trio after
Kill and Enda obviously had done they'd done Man stuff and together numerous other plays together but that was the first time the three of us were back.
I know you've talked about this a million and one times when the film of Disco Pigs was made, and there was Elaine Cassidy that was doing that. Did you have to, or had you broached that well before this point in time with both Cillian and Enda?
Oh God, I mean, it's a long time ago, you know. And actually, Elaine Cassidy and I played sisters in Lindsay Turner's Aristocrats at the Donmar, so that was a few years ago, and that was a lovely thing to kind of go, you know, history has a way of coming back. It's really beautiful. And we were all very lucky to kind of get to play Runt and to work with Enda. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm lucky.
But coming back to small things like these, I mean, it was kind of that I suppose if you know the history, it's just so wonderful to see the two of you up on screen together as husband and wife in this particular case.
Yeah, well, you get a lot for free, you know?
Yeah. You had a big history to in there. Here's a scene between the two of you, and it's Bill Furlong is the character played by Cillian Murphy, who's the local coal man, and he's been up in the convent. He's seen stuff up there with young girls who have been, certainly one particular young girl who it's very clear has been treated very, very badly indeed. And he comes home to you as Eileen to have a little chat about, you know, what do we do when we see things like that?
Don't you ever question it? If you want to get on in this life, there are things you have to ignore.
It's an incredible line, that, isn't it? You know, if you want to get on in this life, there are things you have to ignore. Yeah. That's Eileen Walsh as Eileen Furlong, as she is in Small Things Like These with opposite Cillian Murphy. Because I don't think Eileen Walsh would feel that, but obviously Eileen Furlong does feel that.
Yeah, well, I think it's such a different time. Mm. You know, the ability to talk about anything in a quiet room was very difficult. I think the fear of, you know, ears and walls, and that, you know, God is omnipresent. So it's terrifying. So even, you know, I would have often said that you'd leave space for God in the bed, that like it's his presence. And then therefore the church's presence was everywhere.
Yeah, and also important to remember that the characters had three daughters and
six
daughters. Where I get three from? And the nuns had huge power, or this particular nun had huge power over the potential future of those girls.
Yes, Emily Watson, so brilliant.
Yeah.
So brilliant in it. And Tim Meelands, who directed it, you know, really kind of handled us all with such care and fearlessness when it came to directing any of the scenes. Mm. It was about the time needed to explore and discover everything.
And, you know, I was looking at and thinking about some of the other roles that you've played over the years, and you've come at this topic at different times from different perspectives. I'm thinking particularly of the Magdalen sisters from 2002, Peter Mullen's film, where amazing. You played this young woman who had found herself pregnant. She had learning difficulties and was being so maltreated.
Yeah, Crispina.
When you're playing those, you play that role back then and you come to playing Eileen Furlong, I guess that's a bit like you're saying about yourself and Killian, that history all feeds in, the history of playing that part.
Oh, it does. Peter had us all in a green room where we would all kind of compile all our research. Mm. And so we really kind of went for it with documentaries and articles and books and it really fed my interest for, 1984, 85, all around then in Ireland. And I just felt like my career was really always heading towards finding out more about that. So the Anne Lovett story was very important to be part of. And then...
Because you were also in a film in 2022. And then 2022, this, Called Anne, where you played the mother, didn't
That's
you?
That's right, yeah. And so I think a bit like Second Woman, I feel like my career's been aiming towards this. The idea of doing something as dangerous and as playful as working with 100 different people is like it's culminating in something, you know.
And I guess everything leads on to the next thing. There is an aspect of that within it. But just sticking with the idea of silence for the time being, you were also part of the big TV series Say Nothing. You might explain the character you play in that, again based on reality.
Initially auditioned for the mother and of Dolores and
Marion Price.
Very good, yes. And I didn't get that. And then Nina Gold phoned and said, are you free on Monday?
Nina Gold is a huge casting
director. Massive casting director, so much so that we have a saying in our agency that is never say no to Nina. So she said, can you jump in? Actually, we need you on Monday to do this part. And I was thrilled because it was the only other role that I was kind of interested in within the brilliantly written series. So anyway, it's Aunt Bridie and she is the aunt that lives in the house with them. She herself was a participant in setting of bombs and she unfortunately got caught up in one and lost her eyes and her hands. So, there is no preparing for that. There's no pretending to prepare for that, except that I had prosthetics on my eyes for 14 hours a day.
Had you read the Patrick Radden Keefe book?
No, I hadn't actually, but they had sent me they had sent me six episodes of what was written so far, and it was written with such amazing detail. One episode in particular, which was actually written by a playwright, she did Dance Nation, an American younger woman. She was stunning. And that was the one where the girls are on hunger strike and they hear their mother being interviewed on the radio. It could have only been written by a playwright. Right. It was so beautifully pitched, you know. That was a lesson in silence, really, because you can't talk unless someone is talking to you because you don't know who's next to you. You don't know who's there anymore in the room, you know. It was fascinating to play it. And terrifying because I'm afraid of the dark. So suddenly I was pitched into darkness so for 14 hours a day.
You couldn't see. Yeah. You had whatever stuff over your eyes.
Yeah.
Coming back to The Second Woman and that aspect of it, you mentioned earlier on Marina Abramović. You spoke to Cathy... they've gone clean out of my head now. The performance artist in Belfast, based in Belfast.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Amanda Coogan,
well done, everybody.
Yeah, finally got there. Sorry, Amanda, who's on the programme, I think, next week.
Amanda Coogan.
Job I'm on holidays.
I think Amanda Coogan, most women in the arts will have a small crush on Amanda Coogan. Jimmy Faye's very lucky to be married her, you know. But she's just phenomenal. And I saw her at the Marina Abramović exhibition, her retrospective in London. And she did this very famous piece of kind of living in these three rooms for 6 days. And the only entrance and exit is on this kind of bladed staircase. Mm. So there's no leaving. And Amanda was incredibly magnetic to watch.
And had she advice, particularly because she was in one of these big long marathon pieces as well?
Yes.
She had done that, I think. Was
and
it six
I mean,
days?
A lot of Amanda's own work is very much, you know, this stunning performative duration. I mean, I've spoken to her in the past about previous works, but I think I might need to touch base with her again about how the hell am I going to get through this?
It's the 24 hours aspect of it that kind of...
Yeah, but there's something kind of wonderful about that, because again, you can't prepare for it. And there is that, you know, we all would have pulled an all-nighter in our 20s or whatever.
But you slept all day the next day.
But then you slept all day the next day. Or, you know, doing a night shoot and your body is totally discombobulated at certain points if you've got a week of night shoots or whatever. But I'm kind of thrilled at the idea of what will happen after that. Once you start getting tired, what happens after that? And how does that affect the performance? And maybe you will be really tired and maybe the men will have to carry you a little bit.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting.
But do you have any idea, like 100 people, some of them actors, some of them non-actors, you say that's part of the process here. Do you have any idea who any of them are?
So I think there's 10 that I've possibly worked with over my in my career. But I don't know, except one older man that I adore. That really, every night I was on stage with him and it was different and honest and amazing. And he texted me the other day and he said, I think I'm coming to play with you in Cork. And for just to get to do it with him alone makes it worthwhile for
me. And you won't, I mean, obviously the actors will have to be there backstage and being getting ready to go on and whatever their little patch of time when that is said. You don't go near the green room, you don't see anybody
I won't
beforehand.
Be able to, I'll be...
You'll be on stage the entire time.
The entire time, besides for rest breaks of quick little peas, I guess. But other than that, the participants are all asked to come at a certain time, so they won't be waiting for hours, or they won't be watching hours in advance preparing and getting nervous. So everyone is kind of taken in at their own schedule slot.
I talked about series stealing moments.
Uh-huh.
I'm just flicking it up. That's why I took my eyes off you.
Oh,
speaking. This is Eileen Walsh. What was the character's name in Contessa? Kate, she was. This is Kate, who is a friend of Sharon Horgan's character and has come over for the wedding.
Oh, Lord.
And boy, does she bring a lot of energy with her when she comes into their kitchen.
Oh, there he is. Rob, this is Kate, my maid of honour. Kate, this is Rob, the future Mr. Sharon Morris.
Oh, great to meet you, Kate.
Sharon, can I just talk to you for a moment?
I'm so happy to finally meet you.
It's great to meet you.
You know, you got a good one here. Even if you hadn't gotten her pregnant, she'd be a catch. we are going to have a legendary week. You know, my first time away from the kids in 5 years. I don't miss them. I love London!
Little too happy.
A little bit too happy
to be away from the kids for a couple of days. That's the character of Kate in Sharon Horgan's Catastrophe. Eileen Walsh with me in studio this evening. When you look at what, as we were listening to that, I said to you, given what we were speaking about in terms of the Magdalene Nuns and all of those things earlier, there we can have a joke. Even if you did get her pregnant, we can have a laugh about that now.
Yeah, I mean, Sharon's writing is so bold and in your face, you know, which is what makes it so kind of hysterical as well. But yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it, that like you get to a point now where it's a choice as well.
Yeah.
You know, that she has a choice.
And the other aspect, I suppose, that strikes me, sometimes it's peculiar if you're playing a comedy like that. You can't just go in and say, well, I'll do this bit to get the laugh because it's the funny bit. You have to find a way of making Kate real. Otherwise, she's not going to be funny at all.
Yeah, well, I think that's what's so good again about Sharon's writing is that like Kate would have these very funny, ridiculous, over-the-top, thrilling moments. But it was always quickly followed with, I'm just not happy. And so, you know, even series after series, when she'd come back, it might have been small scenes or whatever, but there was always this thing of, I know I look fabulous. I know I'm living on a houseboat. It's dreadful. Like there was always little chinks in her armor or whatever, you know.
And that aspect of playing comedy on stage, the same type of thing, you have to have a reality, I guess, in the same way as you have to have a reality if it's a tragedy or a drama.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that's when comedy works best, when it's just played for truth, because then we see ourselves reflected in it. You know, it doesn't work if it's just, you know, taking the mick out of something. Mm. You know, that can work once off, but it won't work as a repetition.
I wondered again about The Second Woman.
Mm.
I guess some of the playings of the scene might be hilariously funny.
Absolutely.
And others might be tragically dramatic and heartbreaking.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the whole point is that you can't control that. It's whatever they bring on. And a lot of the time, if they need attention, or maybe they'll be thrilled at the idea of, you know, 800 people looking at them. So that's their enthusiasm can sometimes knock them off course as well, you know, so they can't plan it either.
Obviously, being an actor has brought you to the point where you can be in The Second Woman opposite 100 different men over a 24-hour period. But outside of, you know, what it has brought you within those career terms, what do you think, how much of Eileen Walsh, who's the woman you are sitting opposite me, how much of that is dependent on Eileen Walsh, the woman who goes out on stage or onto the screen?
Wow. Gosh, well, I love my job. And I would very much see myself as a woman and a mum and an actor. You know, it's very much part of me. And I do feel validated as to who I am, which is terrible because of how much I love my job. But I also think a lot of me remains in those characters. You know, a lot of the choices I make as those characters are just a braver version of me, or a wilder one, or a more murderous version. But it's me within them.
Yeah, thankfully, it's only the murderous version that gets to make it onto stage or
you
screen.
You said evil
anyway.
Laugh.
I believe you're going to do a little bit of interviewing soon as well.
Stop it. Listen, I'm picking up tips now here, left, right and centre. I got asked to do kind of a interview conversation thing at Boris Festival of Literature.
Yeah.
And that's the weekend after next. And interviewing Fiona Shaw.
Who I'm guessing the Cork connection obviously will be huge. Must have been a hero of yours growing
up,
was she?
Like, totally. And I remember seeing her in The Seagull in Edinburgh, actually, when I was living there, and being blown away, you know. I think she's utterly compelling and bold in her choices and in her performance, and also in her ability to sit and absorb in a room. She's aware of being good, and she's aware of her value. Now, that's kind of remarkable as a woman to, you know, to be around somebody who's like that. I can't wait to get the opportunity to chat with her.
And that's subsequent to your 24-hour marathon.
That'll be in the middle of it there now. I'll do a bit of rehearsing, nip off up to Boris, interview Fiona.
And then back down to
and
do
then back down.
Well, listen, good luck with it all.
Thanks
and
so
lovely
much.
To see you as always. And that's Eileen Walsh and The Second Woman with Eileen Walsh and 100 actors that she knows one of, although I think she might know more than one. She's not saying, I have a funny feeling. It'll be on in the Cork Opera House for 24 hours from the 14th through until the 15th of June. So 4 p.m. in the afternoon.
4 p.m. on Saturday.
Right through to 4 p.m.
through to 4 p.m.
Sunday, yeah. Jeepers. All part of Cork Midsummer Fest and a festival, and you can get tickets on corkmidsummer.com. In Bono's Stories of Surrender, the U2 frontman trades stadium for stagecraft, offering a stripped-backed, soul-bearing performance that blurs the line between memoir and monologue. Directed by Andrew Dominic and filmed in stark black and white at New York's Beacon Theatre, this documentary invites viewers into a world of music and myth-making. The film received a 7-minute standing ovation after its premiere at the Cannes Film Festival earlier this month. Nadine O'Regan is with me in studio this evening to take a look at this latest chapter in the life of Bono. And in fact, Nadine, you came in armed with
the book.
With the book, because that was the starting point for this, I believe.
Yeah, it was. Surrender, 40 Songs, One Story. It came out in 2022. And it's it's a massive tome, a very thoughtful recollection of his life mediated through, the little hook of those particular songs that he selects. And it is absolutely encyclopedic in a way. I mean, there were points reading it where I felt, okay, perhaps it would be to his benefit to have trimmed it and shortened it. And so it's really interesting in that context to think of this particular Apple documentary, which is sort of a one-man show, a theatrical performance, a scripted performance. And of course, he's performed in many different venues, including in Dublin. And it's actually genuinely, I think, really benefits from having that narrative from the book entirely slimmed down.
Yeah, the important aspect of this is it is a stage performance. It's it's not a documentary where he's a talking head talking to camera telling his story. There is a persona telling these stories.
Yeah, he's part preacher, part soothsayer, part rock star. He inhabits many different realms, even though he's only on stage with a few chairs for company and three
chairs representing the members other
of the band
members.
Yeah, and three musicians accompanying him as well, who are absolutely brilliant, and led by Jackknife Lee, who's a longtime producer on U2's work.
Ellis on cello and Gemma Doherty.
Also really, really fine musicians. Yeah. And it's one of those things where, you know, this could go either way. You know, I think everyone approaches this with, will this work? Because there's no claw, there's no sphere, there's no bandmates.
And he says that himself quite early on.
Can Bono do it on his own? And also, do people want to hear what he has to say? Because this is a man who has everything, who has lived the most extraordinary, rich, wonderful life. His activism, his songs, his bandmates, everything is very totemic. And you feel almost as though it could almost be sickening to hear about what a great life he's had. And I think what Bono does very, very cleverly, because he's a really astute storyteller, is he intrinsically understands that this could be a bit annoying to the general population, even to his fans. So he introduces us to the character of his late father, and he summons him up. And Bob Hewson was...
Who is an empty chair all by himself.
An empty chair on stage, and Bono reacts to that empty chair as though he's having a drink with his father in Finnegan's in Dalkey. And, the father would always say anything strange or startling, and it was made very clear to Bono that he didn't want any of these rock star anecdotes. He didn't want to hear if he was, you know, hobnobbing with Christy Turlington or, you know, supermodels. He didn't want to know if, you know, something amazing had happened, if their latest album had soared to the top of the charts. He was not interested. So Bono says mostly they would sit in silence and he would think about the opera that was playing in his father's mind.
Yeah, what an amazing phrase when he uses that. And the father absolutely loved tenors, adored Pavarotti. And of course, Bono thought, well, I have him finally. Yeah. I'll tell him that Pavarotti is going to wants me to sing with him. He tells a great story. I want to listen to this. He tells a great story about the moment at which they're rehearsing in Windmill Lane, I presume it is, and the lads want nothing to do with Pavarotti. They don't want to be dragged off to Modena for some charity gig, as far as they're concerned. It was for Bosnian war children at the time. But Bono gets a phone call, and the boys disappear off and say, well, no, we're not going to stay around for this. We're going to go into hiding. But here he acts out the phone call, giving us his best Pavarotti Italian accent.
The whole band was in the studio in Hanover Quay when the phone rings, you know? Bono, Bono, Bono. How are you? Are you weary from the mountain top? Have you come down the mountain top with the tablets of rock and roll?
The new album, we're late as always.
You told me this, and dearest Bono, that is why I am here to help.
I'm sorry? You're in Dublin.
I am this very minute in the Irish Customs and Exercise. I have told them I have nothing to declare but my love of Bono, Edge, James and Larry. It is my sole purpose in this moment to be of service to these great men.
Oh, maestro, they are great men, and this is a great honor, but it's not a great moment.
They don't like me?
Oh, it's worse. They don't care. I mean, these are the children of punk rock. They will likely suspect that you are just here to twist their arm into going to Modena.
This pains me. I came only in the genuflection in cordiality, and now you question my motivation. No, maestro, it's not like that. Perfetto. I am on my way.
Bono in a scene there from Bono's Stories of Surrender, the new Apple TV version of his memoir, I suppose. Nadine O'Regan has been watching it for us. And he goes on to Bono, or no, Pavarotti does arrive with a camera crew in case they're going to make an announcement about Modena. So, I mean, there is great fun in this, but I suppose the meat and two veg of this really and truly is the relationship with the father, his relationship with his wife, which is clearly so loving and supportive. Mm. She has been hugely important to him. I think everybody knows that. His absolute respect and love of the three band members. But in the midst of all of that, do we get to know the man behind all of those masks? I mean, he's great at doing the Italian accent and telling the story. Do we get to know the man behind all of that?
I think we get to know him sometimes. And I think there's a brilliant storyteller here. And that storyteller is occasionally coming into conflict with the reality. Because, Bono, when you wrap up somebody's life into art, it can be difficult to make it sing in the way that you want it to. Because life isn't like that. It's messy and chaotic and complicated. And often people don't like to have themselves put forward in that format. So he's actually relatively austere in terms of how he characterizes, for example, the three band members or Ali. You know, he's very careful, and sometimes perhaps there are times when he draws back where maybe you want him to lean forward. But, and there's a big but, you know, there are great moments and long passages here where everything works very beautifully. And the thing that I have to say is wow to the musical performances. His voice is stunning.
Yeah, because there are new versions of songs, and songs that we all know from YouTube. But I heard songs in a totally different way. But the two things that really... It's easy to forget that he lost his mother when he was 14.
He was 14, and his mother took a turn when she was at her own father's funeral. Bono was just 14. She had a ruptured cerebral aneurysm, and that was the last time he saw her. And there's a very poignant moment where he describes how he and his older brother Norman, they were back at the house, their father was back at the house. And after that point, after his mother's passing, their father simply never spoke of Iris again.
Yes,
and
it
is extraordinary.
Her name wasn't to be mentioned, yeah.
And he sees her, you know, in things he's done since, you know, her memory is there. But for a long time, I think there was a block. You know, he describes how I think the band were rehearsing near her graveyard and he didn't go to visit. So I think there's early childhood trauma there. And Bob, you know, Bob...
The father.
Could be very harsh, you know. Like, I mean, we joke about the Pavarotti and him meeting Princess Diana and so on. But there were some moments where, you know, when Bono said, oh, you know, Pavarotti has called me, like the father said, you know, why would a great tenor be calling you? And it is funny, but you start thinking to yourself, no wonder Bono has been able to take the slings and arrows of rock critics over the years, because he'd been very well prepared for it.
And there will be people who are shouting at the radio right now that we're talking about Bono. And there will be people who will approach this. They will hate it from the minute it starts, even without looking at it.
Yeah, and if you don't like Bono, you'll continue not to like Bono. And if you do like Bono, I think that you will see this for what it is, which is a very thoughtful, well-made piece of work and lit up by really extraordinary musical performances.
And he is, there is that very moment you mentioned, the Princess Diana moment when the father meets Princess Diana.
Suddenly, 800 years of impression.
Yeah, gone. Yeah. However, I do want to finish with some of the music because these are new arrangements of the songs. As we say, Jackknife Lee, Kate Ellis on cello and Gemma Doherty on harp and backing vocals at times. I heard the music in ways I hadn't heard it before.
And I think it's because it's so cleverly wound in. Like the camera work here and is very, very clever in that it's multi-angle. It's conceived as almost like a narrative feature film. And the musical approach is similarly tapestry-like and complicated. You know, Bono's voice, even though it's, you know, recorded live before this rapt audience in New York at the Beacon Theatre and filmed by Andrew Dominik, the Australian director, even though we know it's being done live in this format, they've actually storyboarded everything. So it plays out in this exquisitely complicated way when Bono's voice, his vocal, spoken word, rising and falling, and then the cello creeping in, or Jackknife Lee adding in some synths or a little bit of just musical connection. So it feels wonderfully harmonious.
And also we get the context for when the songs were written. You hear them differently when you hear them in that respect.
Yeah, and like a song like I Will Follow, it's thrilling, you know, even to hear it so many years, you know, in the distance, and to think of them as young men starting out, you know, urging each other to be better and better and better. And then, you know, the way he describes, you know, I want a dentist drill, you know, I want a song to sound like a dentist drill. And then when a song like this song emerges, you can hear what he was going for.
However, I think Sunday Bloody Sunday is one of the strongest moments in the entire documentary.
Yeah, and also, like, it's probably important to note as well, although Bono doesn't like labour the point, he does go through his political activism over the years, and he does talk about, you know, the meaning of behind the songs and how certain songs, you know, were effectively protest songs.
A recommendation? Watch it.
I think that it is absolutely worth watching if you are a music fan.
Let's listen to this version of Sunday Bloody Sunday from this new documentary or staged performance. I don't know what to call it in truth. Bono, Stories of Surrender.
Can't believe the news today. I can't close my eyes, make it go away. How long must we sing this song? How long? Tonight, look at his heart. Bottles on the children's feet, bodies strewn across a dead end street. I won't heed the battle call. It's my back up, against the wall.
One of the undoubted highlights for me of Bono Surrender, which is the Bono Stories of Surrender, the new documentary. I don't know what to call it, as I say. It's a kind of a filmed version of his stage retelling of his memoir. It's released this Friday exclusively on Apple TV Plus. And to book reviews now. This evening we're looking at the latest from Galway writer Elaine Feeney. Her new novel is called Let Me Go Mad My Own Way. Elaine, of course, began writing a life as a poet. Well-received collection was described by Fionnuala Flanagan, in fact, the actor, as, quote, the freshest, most engaging and certainly most provocative female poet to come out of Ireland in the last decade. Her debut novel, As You Were, was published in 2020. And was shortlisted for the Rathbones Folio Prize and Irish Novel of the Year, and it won the Kate O'Brien Award. And How to Build a Boat, of course, was our more recent book, was longlisted for the Booker Prize. Alex Clark, editor, journalist, a literary editor, a literary journalist and editor, joins me now to tell us a little bit more about Elaine's book. Good to have you with us this evening, Alex. Tell us a little bit about the protagonist here. We spend a lot of our time in the company of Claire O'Connor, who for large sections of the book is speaking directly to us. Who is she when we meet her?
Yes, that's right. She is, in a sense, in flight from the life that she's had in London. She's gone home to the family bungalow on the outskirts of Athenry, where she originally went to look after her father, who's since died. Her mother died sometime before that. But she is entirely unsettled when the man that she was living with in London, Tom, announces, or rather it is revealed to her by his sister, that he is coming back to live nearby and is going to write a book.
There's nothing like an ex-boyfriend turning up on your doorstep, is it?
I said coming back. He's not coming back.
I was going to ask you that.
He's never been there before. No, he's never been there before, I should have said. And that is actually part of attention. He doesn't come and visit her family at any other point, and suddenly he pitches up when she's just about getting, we don't know quite that she's getting her life together, but she's certainly getting a version of her life without him. On the rails.
So she's clearly discombobulated by the arrival of Tom into her locale. She has a couple of brothers at home and a community around her. Is that aspect of life in Athenry or in this west of Ireland town explored?
Well, it's interesting that she is really quite introspective. She's turned in on herself a lot of the time, and that is part of the problem. She has old family friends who are living next door, and she's close to them. She's quite close to her colleagues at the university. She teaches in the English department there, but she doesn't go out of her way to make connections, and that is something of a problem. In fact, one of the strongest connections she makes is with an internet influencer of what she learns is called the trad wife variety, a woman who puts heart and home at the centre of everything, lives to please and serve her husband and their children. And for some reason that kind of baffles quite a lot of people and perhaps baffles Claire herself, she becomes something of a role model.
So she's kind she's trying desperate to be this Stepford wife type of character.
I think she's very, I mean, it's a novel about conflict and about interior conflict. I think she knows that that's not really who she is and not really what she's going to be satisfied to be. But some aspects of it, I think, in a sense, represent a way out of confusion. And it's a novel about being confused. She kind of wants to get back with Tom. She kind of doesn't.
Yeah.
She wants to be at home. She doesn't. And it's a novel about what happens when you're really not sure what you want to do next.
A couple of set pieces that you've picked out, I think, as particularly impressive, one of which is the father. This is a flashback to her childhood. And she goes into the third person, when she goes back there. But the father is selling a horse to that will eventually make its way to Queen Elizabeth.
Yes. And for the father, who is a very, very difficult man, we've intuited this. We don't get a real chapter and verse on why exactly that is, but it becomes apparent over the course of the novel. He is convinced, probably correctly, that this is going to make the family's fortunes. And there is a kind of extended set piece, as you say. She switches into the third person, and there's a non-explicit suggestion. It may even be just something that I've wondered about. Claire is a writer, and I wonder if this is her writing down her experiences, her as a child. But we see this day when essentially everything that can go wrong does go wrong, but it takes a horribly, painfully violent turn that is clearly traumatizing for everybody involved, and it's an incredibly strong passage in the novel. It really impacted me.
Yeah, and the volatility of the father and the mother's compliance within that, all very kind of disturbing. But there are other sections. Then, I mean, there's a big dinner party where Elaine Feeney really knows how to handle that big setting.
It's so very much the kind of dinner party that you would be, you know, throwing yourself to the floor to escape. You'd sort of be, you'd be stabbing yourself in the leg with your fork and making your excuses. She tries to assemble, and I guess to various extents everybody's done something along these lines, different aspects of her life, her old friend and next door neighbour, her brothers, with whom she has a kind of strained relationship. Mm. They're both very different from one another. Her colleagues from the university, who are actually broadly incredibly supportive, but clearly rather bemused, the new boyfriend. And this is where she really goes to town too on the sort of trad wife aspect of the novel. It's a kind of fanatically over-catered meal at which you kind of feel that everyone should probably put a brake on the drinking early doors, but they're not going to. No, and it gets horribly out of hand.
Yeah, it is going to get worse, that's for sure. One final aspect of the novel that I wanted to touch on is the fact that there's a section of the novel where we go into 1920 and the grandparents of Claire and an episode with the Black and Tans and the death of a young child.
That's right. I mean, these scenes from her ancestors' lives, you know, that she hasn't herself experienced, that have been handed down in some way to her, and are represented by the old cottage in which the family lived, which still exists in the grounds of the bungalow. And yes, once again, it's a very disturbing and violent part of the book. Touches on all these themes about the relationship between Britain and Ireland, and about the themes also of women putting themselves into awkward positions to keep men happy. And again, it's a very powerful part of the book.
Booker Longlis is, as I said, for her last book, How to Build a Boat. What did you make, finally, Alex, of Elaine Feeney's Let Me Go Mad in My Own Way?
I thought it was very, 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 a very strong novel, and I was really gripped by it throughout.
Strong and gripped by it throughout. You can't say much better than that, I guess. Alex Clark reviewing Elaine Feeney's Let Me Go Mad in My Own Way, which is published by Harvill Secker. And that is our lot for this Wednesday evening. James Feeney was on sound this evening. The broadcast coordinator was Emily McAvoy. Leah Murphy researched, and the programme was produced by Sean O'Gorman. Kay Sheehy will be with you tomorrow night on Friday, and I'll be back with you on Bank Holiday Monday in an earlier slot. More of that over the next couple of days. We're going to be on during the day on Bank Holiday Monday and then back to our usual time next Tuesday. But Kay will tell you about that over the next couple of nights. John Creedon will be with you after the 8 o'clock news.